history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there waiting to be told. If we're willing to take the time to ask a few questions, and more importantly, to listen, we might just be amazed by what we hear. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And through that journey, we come away educated, entertained, and often we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. While the coronavirus pandemic has put a temporary moratorium on our ability to go out and sit down face-to-face with veterans, it has also brought World War II into the spotlight, as so many segments of society are experiencing the kind of interruption not seen since the war. Many of our recent programs have marked 75th anniversaries of key events, and there's a big one coming up. Friday, May 8th marks 75 years since VE Day, when the Nazi regime that had terrorized Europe finally surrendered to the Allies. One organization that has been intentional and excellent in commemorating just about every major moment in World War II is the nonprofit Friends of the National World War II Memorial. You've heard me talk about them before. If you're on social media, make sure you look them up and give them a follow. If you already were, this week you would have caught a powerful video for the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Nazi concentration camps. That was happening throughout the month of April in 1945, but April 29th was chosen for what would have been the usual ceremony at the memorial in Washington, D.C., because that was the date surviving prisoners experienced freedom again at Dachau. I have that video linked for you online at hometownheroesradio.com. If you take the time to watch it, you'll find accounts from camp survivors as well as liberators. And as I know you do with the veterans we hear from here each week, you can try to imagine being in their shoes, how you might have felt, how you might have acted. But would you have done what Felix Sparks did? Also featured in that 75th anniversary video from the Friends of the World War II Memorial is a clip I'm going to share here with their permission. It's prolific author Alex Kershaw, who's written multiple bestsellers on World War II themes, talking about the liberation of Dachau on April 29th, 1945, and the man showcased in Alex's outstanding book, The Liberator.
Lieutenant Colonel Felix Sparks, a 26-year-old battalion commander in the 157th Infantry Regiment of the Thunderbird Division, the 45th Infantry Division, climbed over the perimeter wall of Dachau concentration camp and led American soldiers into the longest-standing concentration camp in the Third Reich, and began to liberate it. I am a very big fan of Lieutenant Colonel Felix Sparks, a beautiful definition of moral integrity and courage on the 29th of April, 1945. When we talk about the liberation of the camps, we often focus rightly on the survivors, those who managed to go through that nightmarish ordeal. And in Dachau's case, it was 12 years. Believe it or not, among the over 30,000 inmates on the 29th of April, there were over 50 nationalities, and some of those inmates had been in Dachau since Hitler took power in 1933. 12 years they had to wait for freedom. When Sparks went into Dachau, he saw scenes that he said blew his mind. The human mind could not get around these images, could not process what was happening there. And he said that he lost control of his men for a short period of time. They were so enraged, they were so brutalized by the war, that when they saw thousands of rotting bodies out in the open, fresh spring sun turning blue, and they saw what the German Third Reich had done to ordinary people, they snapped. They lost it. They completely were enraged. And they started to place SS troops into a coal yard within the center of the Dachau complex. And while Sparks' back was turned, while he was inspecting nearby buildings, some of his men opened fire on German troops lined up with their hands in the air in a coal yard in Dachau. Sparks heard the firing. He ran back into the coal yard, and now we start to see these shots, and he put his hand in the air, put his hand in the air and pulled out his Colt 45 pistol, and he started to fire the pistol. And the images you can see now are ones taken from a Signal Corps cameraman's film. He puts his hand up, note where the hand is, the position of the hand, and he shouts out, "Stop!" And the camera captures his hand moving forward as he fires. Bang, 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 bang. And his hand moves forward and he's screaming, "Stop!" So what he's doing is he's stopping the most notorious massacre of German troops, SS troops, I should say, in World War II, in the heart of darkness at the center of Dachau on the 29th of April, 1945. Now, why this matters is it shows an ordinary working class American GI who had fought from the day that Europe was liberated, started to be liberated on the 10th of July, 1943, four amphibious invasions, almost every major battle you could be in and serve in as an American GI in World War II, he fought in. He fought all the way to Germany. Over 500 days later, he finds himself in Dachau. He's lost an entire battalion, 800 guys, to the SS just a couple of months before. He lost an entire infantry company in some of the fiercest fighting in history at Anzio. 200 men, he was the sole survivor. He has every reason to hate and despise the German people, to particularly despise the SS, the Waffen-SS, who have committed these enormous atrocities, which he's now experiencing for the first time today, 75 years ago in Dachau. But what does he do? He does not let his men become like the enemy, become beasts. He stops them. He shows in that one moment that he has an integrity, a core, a moral core, and a courage that allows him to do the right thing at the most difficult time. So I think that today is a very important day because it celebrates and commemorates what happened 75 years ago at Dachau. But it's important to remember in these difficult times that it's men like this, it's people like this that we honor and commemorate, because that image of Spartz represents, I believe, the peak, the absolute peak of moral American authority, moral authority in World War II and in the 20th century, perhaps even in its entire history. Here is the symbol of an ordinary American having fought for over 500 days to liberate the old world, showing what American moral integrity and courage is really about. It's a beautiful, beautiful image and a story of a great, great American who gave everything to liberate Europe.
You can find the photo reference there at hometownheroesradio.com, where I also have a link to Alex Kershaw's book, The Liberator. We're actually going to have Alex on the program to talk about some of the World War II heroes he's written about over the years. Thanks again to the Friends of the National World War II Memorial. If you don't follow their social media feeds, you're really missing out. One of the men who served under Felix Sparks in the 157th Regiment of the 45th Infantry Division was Rex Rainey. Before we hear what he witnessed at Dachau, get a taste of what these liberators had endured over more than 500 days of combat from a guy who joined the National Guard while he was still in high school in western Colorado before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
Tell you the truth, the soldier that tells you he was never scared, I wouldn't believe. But it was a different type of fear. It was a, I may be going down, but some of you are going with me. Well, that was my mentality. You don't go down without a fight. Well, we was on Salerno in defensive position. The tanks and half-tracks were coming down on us, and the report, I don't know for sure, but the report was the tanks were doing a half-circle over a foxhole, and German soldiers were bayoneting them. And someone, thank goodness, had some power and called for air support straight from our front lines. The P-38 is not a popular aircraft, I don't think, but it sure earned the respect of a lot of infantrymen because they came in and they went down our line and came back, and something told me to set up in my foxhole in the back of it, and in my foxhole a 50 caliber slug lit. But they knocked out two tanks, and the rest of them and the half-tracks all fled. So
That's why the Germans called that plane the fork-tailed devil, the P-38. So it saved your guys' lives there. those P-38s that came in, but nearly took your life. This is a friendly fire shell from a P-38 that landed how close to you?
Well, I was in the back of a foxhole, and it landed where my head had been. Because some said set up, and so I set up in the back part of the foxhole.
Like, and we're talking about a split-second decision.
Or less, yeah.
If you hadn't moved, your head's disintegrated.
Right.
But you move, it hits right behind you. And you're not wounded at all?
No.
How do you explain that?
The good Lord looks after you.
I guess so. Is your heart pounding a little bit after something like that?
For a while.
Sergeant Major Rex Rainey would spend nearly a month in the same foxhole at Anzio when the 45th Infantry Division finally started to push out from the beachhead there. He earned a Purple Heart, and he didn't even realize it.
The person I was sharing the foxhole with said, Rex, I've been hit. And I looked at him, and he had a lung out through his back. And I asked him if he could hold on while I got the medics, and he said, I don't know how long I got. So I took him over my shoulder and carried him back to the medics. They went to taking care of him, and I went to leave, and Sergeant Whitlock, that I'd known since Camp Barkley days, said, Rex, where are you going? And I said, back up. And he said, you don't know that you don't have a seat on your pants and you got blood? I didn't know I'd been hit.
Wow.
And he insisted on doctor and filling me up with sulfa powder and bandage and wanted to put me on the ship, but there'd been a couple of Red Cross ships bombed going back to North Africa. I figured I was as safe on the line as any place. So he fixed me up and said, if I don't see you within 3 days, I'll look you up. And he kept his word. 3 days later, he came up and took the bandages off and said, surprisingly, you're going to live.
There were so many memorable moments for Rex Rainey. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. But what he witnessed at the end of April 1945 at Dachau was something he could never erase from his memory.
We were someplace in Germany when that CO's Jeep came wheeling in, hollering for me. And so I asked him what he wanted, and he said, well, Captain thought you might want to go to the car. One platoon of Charlie Company had just entered it. They'd gone in across the railroad tracks on the back way. Well, I guess it was Easy Company from 2nd Battalion took it officially from the front.
And so this is near Munich, the Dachau concentration camp.
Yes.
They ask you if you want to go.
And the company commander thought that I might want to go, so I hollered at the first sergeant and asked if he wanted to see it, and he said yes, so we piled in the Jeep, and a few miles down the road, a bunch of railroad cars, and we first looked at them, and there were bodies in stock cars and in the gondolas and along the tracks and between them and hanging out of them. And it's something you never expected to see. We didn't like what we saw. They had the crematorium, the big gas furnace going, and there was bodies piled up like cordwood that they had been, I guess, thrown in. We were about an hour after the camp was entered before we got in there. I don't think we had an hour before we was ready to go back. And then from then on, it was a simple march into Munich, and
right.
The war was over.
Did you see any of the survivors of the
camp? Oh, yes. Yes, they would come and try to claw on you, get you to take them out. But they were walking skin and bones. I didn't see near all of them, but yes, I saw probably, I don't know, 50 or 100.
You saw enough to get a feel for what had happened there and what kind of
too much
cruelty people were capable of. I don't want to make you dwell on it. But any time I meet someone like you who was there, and I think I mentioned to you, my grandfather was at Buchenwald when it was liberated. It's not just a straw dog. There actually are people in this world that don't think that happened, that think it was all made up. And you were there. You saw it.
I'd hate to tell you how many people were dead or dying in stock cars, in gondolas. Some of them were half in and half out of a train. couldn't move anymore. No, you can't imagine. I can't imagine what it was like, really. And I spent about an hour there.
Yeah. Ended maybe not in the moment, but eventually did that experience and your coming face to face with that give you maybe even a new understanding or appreciation for how important the work that you'd been doing over there was?
It made you do a little thinking. It made you willing to travel to Denver when that Colonel Sparks arranged for a marker in remembrance of the Holocaust to be placed. But yes, I thought it was worth a trip from Delta to Denver to pay respect for something being put up for them.
There's something else along those lines I want to touch on with you. I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you. Was VE Day a big deal for you?
We read about it in Stars and Stripes. That's all I know about it until after I got back to the States. When you see pictures, and you don't know how true they are, but the Normandy invasion, a lot of men gave their lives up. VE Day was important, yes. I just happened to think of the Second Battle of the Bulge, and we were in Alsace at the time. We didn't suffer many actual KIAs, but we had a lot of injured from tree bursts. We had never encountered tree bursts before, and snow's on the ground, you don't dig foxholes very well. Our artillery was out of ammunition, and we could see seven tanks coming, and suddenly everything stopped. Thank God they ran out of gasoline. They were out of gasoline out down here, for once they were down low. We were up high. We were out of artillery shells. They were out of gasoline.
If they had had 5 more minutes of gas?
It would have taken them at least that much or a little longer. If they had had 20 minutes more gas, there would have been something else.
You guys would have been wiped out.
A good chance.
You keep giving me examples of somebody looking out for you.
No question about it.
And I come back to when I asked you about going overseas, and you said, didn't really think you'd be coming back. When you did come back, what was that like for you to see America again after 500 days at war?
It was a while. If you would believe this, on my way from Munich, they had told me that I'd be taken to Le Havre and flown back to the States for a 45-day leave.
Uh-huh.
Then some brass preempted, and so enlisted men got in 48 cars and headed to Marseille. And I came down with malaria on the way to Marseille. So I spent 11 days in the hospital in Marseille before I got on board ship. I don't remember the voyage. I don't remember coming into Patrick Henry. I don't remember a train ride. I remember coming to in Denver at the Federal Center. It was called up by name and serial number. And I went up, and the guy took a quick look. And he said, "Sergeant, you sure you want to leave?" He said, "I can see 127 points, and we're discharging people with 85. And I said, "What's the catch?" And he said, "You might have to spend up to 24 hours more here." No problem. I don't know what it was really like, but I remember I got my discharge at a little after 11 that night, and I went down to Denver, went into a store and bought a suit, left all my army outfit in there and wore a suit and shirt and tie out. And then I got a hotel room.
How long was it till you made it back to the farm and saw your folks?
I caught a train out the next morning.
What was that reunion like?
It was good. They had no idea. It was in the States even. I don't know, someone had called them, and they met me in town.
A moment you never thought was going to happen.
For a long time, I didn't think it would, but it all worked out.
Rex Rainey passed away in 2018 at the age of 96. He went to college on the GI Bill after he came home, married the secretary at the first school where he taught, and enjoyed a long career in education. His vivid memories are educating us today. It's time for a break, but when we come back, more accounts from liberators and witnesses. Don't forget to watch that outstanding and thorough video from the Friends of the National World War II Memorial online. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking 75 years since the liberation of Nazi concentration camps. If you caught our last episode, we heard about the Holocaust from one of the first Americans through the gates at Ohrdruf, and from two Jewish American veterans, including one whose parents and brother were victims of the Holocaust. If you missed it, you can listen anytime at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find the outstanding video put out by the Friends of the National World War II Memorial Organization. One caveat when it comes to liberation accounts, the major camps like Buchenwald and Dachau had dozens and dozens of subcamps, so oftentimes memories of a camp may be labeled as the main facility when what that veteran really encountered was one of the subcamps. That's where photographs and unit records can come in handy to help clarify. Just something for you to remember if you have a family member that witnessed this history, and especially if that family member is no longer with us. At the end of April 1945, Des Moines, Iowa native Richard Morris was in a half-track belonging to Company C of the 65th Armored Infantry Battalion, part of the 20th Armored Division.
This is a story that takes one day. It takes 24 hours. In the morning, we were getting ready to fall into a column, and a number of vehicles were moving south, and we were going to be in position to attack Munich. That was the day that I said our half-track was pulled out to help guard an enclosure of prisoners. And since we were delayed, and since I was the guy, it was the map guy, I said, in order to catch up with our main outfit, let's go down a gravel road. And so we went down a gravel road. It was beautiful rural countryside. And all of a sudden, we came into a huge, high-walled enclosure. And it was huge enough that it actually, from the view that we were looking at it, it covered up most of the camp. It was the Dachau concentration camp. We didn't know about that. We didn't know about concentration camps. Anyway, as we got close to where the doors were on this wall enclosure, they opened up, and several men came out waving at us in those dirty pajama-like outfits, striped outfits, and they kept waving. So I told Sam, our driver, I said, stop for a minute, and I'll run up and see what this is. So I went up, and they hugged me, and they were so full of joy. And I didn't realize, you know, that we were the sign that they would be saved. And while they were holding on to me, they drugged me inside the doors. They pulled me right behind an oven and opened the door and made me look inside to see there were bodies in there. They were going to pull me to the next oven, and I noticed a huge pile of dead bodies, higher than I was. And I thought, my God, what is this? And the only thing that came to mind was they must have the Black Plague, and they're cremating them to kill the germs. And so as they were pulling me in to see more, I started pulling away to get away from it and get out. And I finally got out and went back to the half track. And I said to the lieutenant, do you want to see what this is? No. When I told him, he said, no, I don't want to see it. So he said, get on the radio. Well, I said, all I can tell you, there's a lot of sick men in that part of this enclosure. And so I got on the radio. And when I started to talk about it, I couldn't even explain. I said, you know, I'm giving you the coordinates of a place where there's some very sick people. They need medics. And that's all I could say about it. That same day, because we were out of our column, we got into a line of vehicles that was a mixed. We had a 2.5-ton truck in front of us. We had a tank behind us. Well, anyway, in the middle of the night, I got hungry. I don't think I had anything to eat all day. And so I got into our sea rations, little cans about the size of cat food. I got something, I think it was beans and ham. And anyway, it made me sick, so I got out of the half track to throw up. I carried my blanket with me, and I put my rifle, I hung it on my shoulder upside down so it wasn't sticking up. And I covered myself up with this blanket, and I decided, I just need a walk. I think I'll walk up this convoy and see what's on it. It was just a variety of things. Many who looked like they were out of their unit, like we were. So anyway, I got back, and I decided to walk in front of us, and there was only a 2.5-ton truck in front of us. And I walked around it, and two guys in there were sleeping. So I pulled the door over, and I said, "What in the hell are you doing stopping here?" And they said, "Because there's a little bridge up front that's been bombed. It's not safe for us to cross it." So I went up and checked the bridge, and I thought, I think it's wide enough. Anyway, I thought it was wide enough for a half track. Just then, a lieutenant from the tank came up. He said, "Sir, can I help you?" And I thought, well, yes, as long as I'm in control of things, yes. I said, "Get this 2.5-ton truck off the road." I said, "We're going to go ahead with the half track, and you and everybody behind us can just follow us." And so we got over it okay. I told Sam, "I'm going to walk in front of you." And we had flashlights that had slits in them. I'd get far enough ahead that he could see the slit, but also could see where the road was. So I led this whole column of mixed vehicles. We came to a T-crossing. I was out there in front by myself, and the guy said, "Halt, what's the password?" And I said, "I don't know what the hell the password is, but I'm from Iowa, and I want to know where the half tracks have gone that came by this corner." He said, "I never saw any half tracks." So I thought, oh, good. I shouldn't say this, but the lieutenant didn't know as much as we did. He was a 90-day wonder who got to be a lieutenant by graduating from college. And so we asked him what he thought we should do, and he said, "Let's go to the right." So we went to the right. We'd gone about probably 3/4 of a mile, and Sam said, "We got to find a place to stop. We're running out of gas." So there was a farmhouse, and in Bavaria, farmhouses had the barn right next to the house. It was as clean as a house. Well, anyway, the lieutenant goes in and decides he's going to take possession of the house so we can sleep on the beds. There were two women in the house, and she immediately started screaming, and they were grabbing these down quilts, and they were carrying on. So the lieutenant said, "All right, get out of here and take them up the road." So after taking everything good out of the bedrooms, we decided to sleep in the barn. And the half track went on one side of the building, and we had a guy on guard on the other side of the building. And I suppose this was about 4 o'clock. Well, we all settled down, the rest of us settled down in the barn on straw, and we were just getting to sleep, and pretty soon our 50 caliber went off. The irony of me in the corner of this barn trying to take a crap when the 50 caliber machine gun goes off, I can't explain to you. I got up and got dressed as fast as I could, and grabbed my gun and got outside, and I went to the half track, and a young buddy named Duffy from Brooklyn was on the half track, and he said, "I just saw some German soldiers coming across the field." It was just clear enough that he could see them. Well, he said, "Halt," and they didn't halt, so he just started shooting, and a couple of them stood up and held their arms up, and we assumed the other three were killed. So anyway, two guys came forward, and one, I'm pretty convinced, was an SS officer. He'd taken off the insignia, but he had an SS officer's outfit on and everything. The other guy was an ordinary guard. The guard kept his hands up, and he kept shaking. He was shaking so bad, we told him and the officer to sit down on the ground. Both of them, we offered them some hot coffee and some cigarettes. The irony is, I think they thought we were going to kill them. Nobody had told us what to do with prisoners. And we didn't feel like killing them because we thought they suffered enough by being having their buddies killed. Anyway, I walked up to this officer, and I noticed a large hunk of his shoulder, his arm, about 3 inches below the shoulder, had been cut out by a 50 caliber. And when it hits the flesh, it just cut a neat strip out of there. I looked at it, and I thought, That's amazing. That's flesh almost deep enough to go to his bone. I pointed it out to him, and he said, well, he just was ignoring the pain, I think. So I had him take his jacket off, and all of us had little first aid kits, which were a bandage and little packages of sulfur. So I sprinkled the sulfur on it and put the bandage around it. I think the lieutenant says, well, what are we going to do with these guys? And we had no place to put them on a half track. So by that it was light enough, we could see another farmhouse down the road. And we said, just go on down there. The ladies will take care of you. And so we let him go. I honestly believe we might have been dealing with the guy who was in charge of the Dachau concentration camp. He seemed like a perfectly nice guy. He was, you know, overwhelmed by our kindness. And the guy whose arms were shaking never did stop shaking, but they both left and walked down the field.
And explain to us why you believe that. I mean, I'm sure it has to do with the fact that he was an SS officer and the proximity to the camp, because you're still pretty close to the concentration camp at this farmhouse, huh?
The logic of finding them there became clear to me as I thought about it. The Dachau concentration camp is north of Munich, and we were going south to get closer to Munich. And I think these guys and perhaps other officers from the camp went through a woods. And so by the morning we were at camp there, they start coming out of the woods. Those would be the only officers I could think of that would be in the area.
And because when you were in the camp, as you stumbled upon it, had never even heard of this idea of a concentration camp, didn't know what was being done to the Jews and those other political prisoners, you didn't see any officers there. All you saw was prisoners, right?
Exactly. And another thing, we had never been given much information about the clothing or the appearance of German soldiers and officers. I only learned this later when I did find out what German troops looked like and their officers. But the SS troops, as far as I was concerned, were the elite officer corps. And I think this man was in that rank. I'll never stop wondering, how come that feeling that we were going to be there to kill the German soldiers and win the war, how come we were not more angry at them? I think it was because we were all young and we all had not been... They never talked to us about what to do with dead bodies and with people that we might capture. They never talked to us about that, so we honestly didn't know what to do. That day we went into Munich, and Munich is the capital of Bavaria, and I learned later Bavarians never really liked the Nazis, and they didn't like the Prussian attitude about fighting all the time, but they had go along with it because Hitler had his forces were strong enough to stop anybody from disagreeing. But as we entered the city of Munich, people were putting their white sheets out of their windows and waving them at us to let us know they were happy and, you know, happy that we were coming and, in a sense, had saved them.
I know some of it is easier to talk about than others, and I don't want to make you dwell on it, but there are even people today who believe that it never happened, that these atrocities were not committed, that 6 million Jews and so many others were exterminated. But you saw it firsthand. So as painful as it might be to discuss, can you tell us what you saw, what kind of shape these human beings were in, and how devastating it was to witness all of that?
Yeah, I would say the whole scene and all of the men, and maybe there were about six that were actually in the crematorium working in there, and they looked like skin and bones. And as I think back about what I know about the Dachau concentration camp, they were the healthy ones. They were the ones that were expected to lift bodies, put them in the ovens. I learned later in the Dachau concentration camp, it was built right when Hitler started, and it was to be a prototype for other concentration camps. The camp was built for about 20,000 people. When it was liberated, it had about almost 40,000 for every barracks. Let's say a barracks had 100 men. In every barracks where they had beds for 100 men, there would be 100 dead people also in those barracks. The Germans just let them lay there. Anyway, what that did to traumatize me, all my life I have had nightmares about somebody pulling me somewhere on my arm. And only recently did I begin to realize there's a connection with those guys pulling me into that crematorium to look at all that. It was sufficiently troublesome that I kept falling out of bed when I was sleeping with my wife, so I started sleeping on the floor rather than falling out of the bed. And I'm sure she thought it was because I didn't love her or something, and to me it was equally confusing. But up until recent years of my life, If I have a nightmare, that's the one that scares me. And in this house, I've fallen out of the bed several times, thinking I'm being pulled towards something I don't want to go to. That kind of reaction, I have learned, is a PTSD-type reaction. And that type of trauma cannot be dealt with by medicine alone. All you can do is kind of calm yourself down, and so that's what I've been doing. And the problem is, when you get out of the service, you don't talk to anybody. But I don't think I ever told anybody about the details of my experience in the crematorium.
That was Richard Morris, who passed away in 2019 at the age of 94. He spent much of his career in vocational rehabilitation. His own battles with PTSD gave him a heart for those facing mental, emotional, and physical challenges to overcome. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, three more Americans who were there when those concentration camps were liberated 75 years ago, including how the experience there ties into the message one veteran is still proactively sharing at age 96. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode devoted to the liberation of Nazi concentration camps 75 years ago. The first camp to be liberated was Ohrdruf on the 4th of April, 1945. You can tap into our most recent episode for what the first Americans through the gates there experienced. On April 12th, three preeminent American generals visited that camp, making sure the gruesome reality of the atrocities committed there would be documented for history and witnessed by civilians from the neighboring towns. That was also the day that a young ambulance driver from California named Jim Sanders arrived at Ohrdruf. The 20-year-old had seen some pretty horrible things in helping wounded Americans and even some wounded enemy soldiers throughout the war, but what he was about to witness would shock his system.
Someone ordered us to go down to this camp, one of the sub-camps of Buchenwald, called Ohrdruf. Well, no one had told us about the concentration camp. We had no idea. So we drove down about 30 miles to this little town of Ohrdruf, you know, to find out, and they sort of, everybody knew where the camp was by then. And so we went up the hill through the gate with the big deal over the gate. We pulled in, and all we saw were dead people. I mean, we'd seen dead and dying people, but these people, they were trying to get rid of. They were trying to burn the evidence, and they couldn't get it done. The ones that could still walk, they'd started to move them back to Buchenwald, walking. That day, that particular day, I don't know why, but we were there when Patton, Eisenhower, and Bradley drove, and Walton Walker, who was the 20th Corps commander, drove in their jeeps to see the place. And that was the day that Patton had the mayor and the people in town come up to see this place. And, of course, they all knew it, but there wasn't anything they could do about it. And the mayor and his wife went home that day and committed suicide. And I met the mayor, present mayor, and his wife of Ohrdruf when we were back there. They're still trying to outlive that stigma of having the camp up on their hill of the town. And I don't know until all of us are gone, they're not going to get away from it. You know, it was just too much. Our vocabulary wouldn't cover it. You know, it was too much. And our only involvement in this, the whole thing from Buchenwald and Ohrdruf, was that we were with the ambulance and someone, we don't remember who, ordered us to pick up people that were lying in the fields. They couldn't, we assume, and we talked about it, we think they were the people that were moving from Ohrdruf back to the camp. Now, Ohrdruf was only one of the subcamps. There were about 80 subcamps around Buchenwald where they went to work. Now, Buchenwald itself was not a killing camp per se. It was not a gas camp. They died. Thousands died, but they, malnutrition, beatings, whatever. But they were asked us to pick up people that were lying in the fields. And we didn't know what they were. They were in little striped pajamas with little patches, and we could put two on a litter. Can you imagine that? One's head up here, one's head down there. Those Germans are still trying to live down this thing of the Holocaust. They're still trying to live it down all these years later. And the only time they'll be able to get rid of it is when we're all gone. And part of the reason I wrote the book was because of the Holocaust deniers, too. As long as I'm alive, these eyes still remember it. It's still up here in the computer, this brain called a computer. It's still there. I can still see it today.
The memories of Jim Sanders, who passed away in 2018 at the age of 93, he chronicled his experiences at Ohrdruf and through the rest of the war in the book Saving Lives, Saving Memories, which I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. The day Jim was at Ohrdruf, the larger camp at Buchenwald had been liberated for less than 24 hours. Lila Morrison, a young nurse from Georgia, was eventually sent there to care for some of the survivors.
That was terrible. That was bad. I still have a hard time believing it. And I saw it with my own eyes.
Did they prepare you for that? Did you have any idea what you were walking into there?
Not really. We didn't have time for that. I'd heard about them, of course, before I ever left the States. But there's a lot of difference in hearing about it and seeing it with your own eyes. That was hard. I still dream about that a little, because that was the largest concentration camp in Germany. And we arrived there, like I told you, that night. They told us, well, you girls have to go down in the morning to help with some of the prisoners. So the next morning we were ready to go, and they came up and said, you girls can't go. You're not going today. Our doctors are already down there, and conditions are so deplorable. We can't let you go down. So we didn't go that first day, but we did the next day. And they had it cleaned up pretty good from what it was. That was where they pyramided the bodies, and they had trenches dug, and they just pushed the bodies over into the trench. This is where they experimented with many of the prisoners. You know, you've read about the doctors.
My grandfather was doctor through the gates at 3:15 p.m. That's why the clock on the gate still says 3:15. Yeah. And the German doctor bragged to him about what they had done. And you've seen and read and the human lampshades and all the horrendous things. But what did you see when you got there that jarred your senses and your understanding?
Well, in the first place, the prisoners looked like they were worse than skin and bones. You wondered how they could even walk. And they all had the striped uniform on, you know. A lot of them had left, and the only means they had was walking. And we called them DPs. They were displaced persons.
Right.
But people from Czechoslovakia or wherever, they were walking home. And it was hundreds of miles. I don't know how they ate. Some of them even had babies. You wondered how in the world they could have kept them alive. But this man that took us through had been a prisoner there for quite a while. He had a jewelry store in Prague. And the Germans came in there one day and said, you know, come on, you're our prisoner. And so they brought him up to the camp. And he was married and had two children and owned a jewelry store. But he didn't know where his wife was or where his children were. He didn't know. But he took us all through the camp, took us up to the crematory, was kind of on a little hill, took us all through there and told us what happened to the prisoners. They had to slide down into the basement and take all their clothes off because they told them they were going to take a shower. So then they'd hit them on the head with it. Looked like it's a big stick, and it looked like a pine knot. As they slid down, he told us they hit them in the back of the head, and they were knocked out, thankfully. Then we went upstairs to where the crematory was, and it was like a two-story thing, brick, and you stepped down into it, and they had eight ovens there, eight here. They had a wall there, big, long wall, and it had bottles with ashes. Now, I don't know why they saved those, but that's what they told us that were there. That was a tough one. I still think of that and dream of it. Yeah, that was the worst. You couldn't understand how in the world you could treat another person that way. But we had one real good thing. It had a big iron gate and barbed wire really twisting around. It had a sign in English across, and it said 6.5 million Jews and political prisoners have been annihilated. And this man had apparently been a prisoner there for quite a while. And he ran up to us and he said, "Oh, you're Americans, you're Americans." And we said, "Yes." And he said, "Oh, I've been here. But when the Americans came, they had those big tanks." Oh, he was smiling. He was so happy. And I'd just never forgotten him. How wonderful he was there when he was free. And oh, they loved America. All of us, no matter who we were heroes to them.
And I imagine as tough as all of that was to see, that probably was as powerful an indication as any of how important the work you'd been doing was.
Oh, it was. Just made your heart want to pop. You were so happy to see at least one man. But you couldn't help but think about those 6.5 million, too.
Absolutely.
For no reason. The only reason was because they were Jewish.
That was Nurse Leela Morrison, an amazing lady. You can link to her complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And we finish today with one more veteran whose experience at Buchenwald and later encounters with those who questioned it have led to decades of speeches and dramatic presentations that are ongoing, even at age 96 and even during the coronavirus pandemic. Jimmy Weldon served overseas with the 1270th Engineer Combat Battalion.
Mainly our stuff was still building the pontoon bridges and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll never forget when we went through Buchenwald concentration camp and we saw these people laying on these wooden slabs, reaching out under there trying to say, thank you for helping us. We thought, I can't believe this. It's not possible. We walk on through the barracks and we go out in the back and there are cubicles back there in the back. Hundreds of bodies nude laying in these cubicles just like they've been thrown out like you would with cattle or something waiting to be cremated. We thought, this is not possible. That will I'll never forget.
Mm-hmm.
But
had you ever, before you got there to Buchenwald, had you ever heard of this idea of a concentration camp? Did you know that the Jews were being exterminated and tortured and treated the way they were?
Well, we heard it, but it didn't register because it's like a lot of people didn't even know this when they lived very close to it because they kept it away from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You just young. See, again, we're young kids, and we're in the army. We're going.
What was the biggest impact of that experience on you? Of what you saw, what you heard, what you witnessed there?
Well, the engraved in my mind is our going through the barracks. Just really to see these people, to think, I can't believe here. They're laying on those wooden slabs, just enough room to slide in and out, and then. I remember seeing one man when we went in the back in one place. He was just sitting there, the little face looking like, I don't know what's happening. He was just alone sitting there, and I thought, golly, I couldn't talk to him or anything. There's no way. But those are the things that are in my mind that I wouldn't want to forget either. But
sounds like it was appalling to you, but also just shocking to know that people could be treated that way?
That's right. That's it. I'll never forget our platoon sergeant when he stood there and started crying. And I thought, golly, Moses, powerful guy. But it was through such, like, what's happened? What are we seeing? What are we seeing here? We're going through things. We're doing things that are not as close to this. And I think, well, that was it. We were fortunate in the sense that I missed a lot of that. When we were doing our work, we were kind of by ourselves. But when you see the things like concentration camps, I'm still thinking it's almost a dream.
Jimmy Weldon would meet his wife in England after the war. They both were performers. One of his most memorable roles came as the voice of the cartoon duck Yakky Doodle on the Yogi Bear Show. But in recent decades, Jimmy has spent much of his energy trying to educate younger generations about the America he loves and the history he believes they should understand.
My passion today is talking to young people about America. I did a thing that was used on the USS Kennedy in the Persian Gulf during the Iraq War for 4,500 sailors. It's a flag, a tribute to our flag. I want you to imagine that you're looking at a flag, standing, and I'm out in the audience, and I'm going to walk up to the flag and hold it, and not even look at the audience until I say the end. And here it is. I am the flag of the United States of America, conceived in the dreams of liberty and the hopes of freedom. I was designed by the hands of Betsy Ross, and her sewing basket was my cradle. Though I was never an orphan, I was adopted by the Continental Congress in 1777 and proclaimed the national emblem of a nation newly born on this continent, fighting valiantly for survival and destined to bring to all mankind a new concept in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I rode with Ethan Allen, the Green Mountain Boys, at the Battle of Fort Bennington. I was flown above the decks of Old Ironsides and the mass of Yankee Clippers. I blazed the trail with Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett. I led the settlers coming west and crossed Death Valley in a covered wagon. Once I fell to the ground at Custer's last stand at the Little Bighorn, there were no living hands left to pick me up. But I galloped up the slopes of San Juan Hill with Colonel Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders in the United States Cavalry. I was carried through the halls of Montezuma onto the shores of Tripoli by the United States Marine Corps. I stayed with the boys till it was over there, on the battlefields of the Marne, Chateau Thierry, St. Mihiel, and the Argonne Forest. I saw many of the youth and manhood of our nation fall and lie still in death, that given their last full measure of blood. The war was over for them forever, but I kept my lonely vigil over their graves and stayed to watch the poppies growing amid the crosses row on row in Flanders Field. I was raised by six brave Marines and sailors during the hell of Iwo Jima in the final hours of World War II. Haven't changed much, 239 years. I still have my original 13 stripes, but as each state came in the Union, a new star was proudly added to the constellation of my blue field. Start with 13, now they're 50. I've draped the caskets of our nation's heroes and borne to their last resting place the bodies of presidents, generals, admirals, humble privates, and the unknown soldier. Wherever free men gather, wherever there's justice, equality, faith, hope, charity, truth, and brotherly love, there too am I. When you stand with your hand over your heart and recite the Pledge of Allegiance to me, don't merely mouth the words, but think of what they mean to you and mean what you say. And when you come to the phrase One Nation Under God, remember it matters not what your religious belief. It only matters that you hold your faith dear, that you practice it daily, and that you preserve it forever. History will never write my obituary, for I am the stars and stripes forever. I'm Old Glory. I'm your flag. I am you. I did that for the Burbank Middle School. The little boy in the back of the room said, that never happened when I told him I was with Patton's 3rd Army Combat Engineers that liberated Buchenwald concentration camp. When he said that, I just screamed out, don't say that! I was there! He backed up against the wall. Later, I talked to the largest Lions Club in Long Beach. When I mentioned this, a little man came out of the audience with a yarmulke on the back of his head, and he said, Jimmy, I'm Rabbi Cain. I was at Buchenwald concentration camp. We stood there hugging and crying in the middle of the room. Later, he had a program called Survivors of the Holocaust and had me speak.
And so many have heard Jimmy Weldon speak since then. That experience actually inspired him to create a nonprofit called the Center for Youth Patriotism. He's 96 now. I had the privilege of chatting with him this week. The coronavirus pandemic has put him on lockdown in his Southern California home, so he's had to postpone some of his speaking engagements. But others, he's still keeping up with virtually. A 96-year-old veteran sharing his love for our country on Zoom. Just one more example of the reality that when Nazi concentration camps were liberated 75 years ago, those persecuted prisoners weren't the only ones whose lives were forever changed. Thanks again to Alex Kershaw and the Friends of the National World War II Memorial. Make sure to watch that commemorative video online and join us again next time on Hometown Heroes when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.